Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast and have a great day.
My name is Brenda. I'm a recovering lesbian, Hispanic, Catholic, alcoholic, drug addict, full physical life. I think that pretty much gets everything, don't you think? And I've been a member of AAA since 1974. And Bambi is my friend. Oh my God, I am so glad to see you. Me da mucho gusto estar aquí con ustedes. Le doy gracias primeramente a Dios por la vida que me ha concedido. Es una cosa muy grande y muy maravillosa y me da mucho gusto estar con ustedes. Y con su permiso voy a hablar en inglés. De nada. In English, hi. How are you? Y'all didn't let me finish, okay? Oh my God, I am so glad to be here. You are going to be impressed. As will I, as soon as I figure out what the hell we're going to talk about tonight. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation. For those of you who came and weren't sure what to expect, if this is any indication, we are in for one hell of a weekend. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's a valid question to ask, who does this? Who goes for a weekend to a place where people are, by their own choice, sober? And truth tellers. I mean, if you thought you could hide, you wouldn't be here. So for whatever brought you, whether it was your joy, your need, your grief, your celebration, your hope, your hopelessness, the fun of it all, whatever it was that brought you here, I celebrate that with you. Whatever it is that brought you here, I want you to know this is the perfect place to bring it. Absolutely. Thank you. And I'm already impressed. This is only like my third time to Florida, and this is only the second time I've been on this side of the state, and I'm already impressed just with the little strip, the drive. Because I went too far when I got here, and when I turned around, you know, there are no mistakes. Because when I went too far and I turned around, I found out there's a place to get a massage and a colonoscopy. Right next door. So, you know, if I'm not here for the rest of the weekend, I'm kind of busy. I remember they invited me to speak in Houston once, and they asked me to speak first on the weekend, and I don't usually do that, but what the hell. So they asked me to speak first, and they expected me to be this lively, cheerful speaker, and I just wasn't in that place. I wasn't in their place, and I got up there, and like people weren't even in their chairs yet, and there were tears already streaming down my face. And I was reading out of my journal because that was the only way I knew how to open that day. And people would come in and go, "What the hell happened? We just got here, you know." And so my hope is that you get whatever it is you came looking for. I know what I want to give you. I know the experience I wish for you. But mostly I hope that you get whatever you came looking for. There's a line in the book that says, now it's either in there or not, I don't know, but there's a line. Well, see, after a while, I can't tell what I wrote in and what was actually there, you know? And I used to love to say that. I said, there's a line in the book, and people would come back and go, that's not in there. And I'm like, I'm just glad you're in the book now. So I've always felt like I've been doing my part to get people in the literature. But there's a line in the book or not that says the consciousness of your belief will come to you. Oh, good. People have heard it. That's always a good sign. And so I hope that the consciousness of your desire and the consciousness of your belief comes to you this weekend. I was brought up in Alcoholics Anonymous that when you go to a meeting, you go and introduce yourself and say hello. And so I had just a moment to come around to some of you and say hello. And it's truly my pleasure to meet you. And when I looked at you and I looked you in the eye and I said, I'm glad you're here, I actually meant that. And I wasn't that person when I got here. I never knew how to say what I meant, and I never knew how to mean what I said. And so it's been remarkable what's happened to me in the time I've been sober. The last time I had to drink or do drugs to change the way I was feeling was on July the 3rd of 1990. And this last July, by the grace of God, I was able to celebrate my 17 years sober. Now, I know that there's many, many people here who have been sober longer than that. And all I can say to you is thank you for coming to meetings. I think that sometimes the old timers, the greatest service they provide to our fellowship is that they sit around and listen to people like me who think we friggin' know everything already. You know, I don't know how many times they wanted to say, if you would please, in the name of anything that's holy, shut the hell up. And while they have said that, they haven't said it in my presence, you know? The reason I know that they've had the experience is because I've had it. Listening to some of y'all. And so I'm grateful to those of you who've been sober longer than I have, because you have walked a path and you have cleared a path. And you have shown up this evening sober, sober women, women of hope, women of gratitude, women of love, women of everything that is good and whole. And I celebrate that with you. For those of you who have less time, welcome. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm the kind of person, and I say this a lot, but I'm the kind of person that once you get to know me, you'll understand. If there was nothing here, if there was nothing here worth staying for, I would have had no problem at all standing outside and going, go home, it sucks. Bad. And so I'm glad to share that that's not my experience. And I want y'all to know, I get a lot of energy from you when I speak. When I get a chance to do this, I get a lot of energy from you. But mostly because I enjoy looking out and seeing you. And seeing your eyes and seeing that you're sober and seeing that you're happy and seeing that you're not. Mostly I enjoy seeing the people who are already pissed. You know, I lost them at the introduction. They're like... They're sitting in their chairs right now wondering, is any of that contagious? And so to those of you that I'm looking at that have already decided that you're not happy, come back tomorrow. There's another speaker. That's the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I only get a chance to do this because it's my turn. Tomorrow it's somebody else's turn. And I think they let me go first so that, you know, they could clean it up the rest of the weekend. I do, and then everybody would leave with a positive feeling, okay? So remember, guys, we're moving toward positive, okay? All right. All right, that's enough of the crap. Did I thank the committee? Did I do that? Well, yeah, okay. So anyway, so I never know where we're going, really. You know, and I was just sharing with Judy, when I was getting ready to come in the room, that I have no idea what we're going to talk about tonight. And I mean none. Absolutely. And I want you to know that's the best friggin' news I've had all day long. Absolutely. Because the great thing about it is that I woke up this morning and went right into chores. Chores? The things you do around the house? You're all looking at me like, what? Chores, work, and then I like got dressed and went to the place where they pay me to go every day, you know, and then I got in the car and I drove here, and then I just like, you know, and then it's my turn, and I'm like, oh my God. So I'm so glad, because I haven't had any time to think about what you should be told tonight, you know, I just, but part of the message, you know, and so... So I'm going to try to be really well behaved, but I want you to know that there's a line that says, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which should interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. And I want you to know that the message that I bring you tonight has depth and has weight. I want you to know that it is not a waste of time, because my question when I go listen to the speaker is, are they going to suck? Like, I'm about to, like, invest an hour of my life. I don't know what else I would be doing with that hour, but I don't want to waste it, okay? So I want you to know that the answer's no. They say to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I had a sponsor who said, Brenda, when they ask you to go speak, you don't need to reference the last 17 years. If you're working the steps, if you have a sponsor, if you have a home group, you can just probably reference the last 17 hours. So there's a real good chance that that may be what you hear tonight. Now, one of the things that just, it's really hard sometimes, because people hear your story and then they have the favorite stories that they want to hear again and again and again. So if I don't tell them, too bad. However, if you go get one of the old CDs, all that stuff's on there, okay? And somebody mentioned to me a little while ago, it's like, I heard you at the convention and I came because I heard you were speaking again and I wanted to see if you had changed your story. And I'm like, oh, shit. I don't remember what I said yesterday. How the hell am I going to remember what I said 2 years ago? And the truth is I hope so. I hope so. I hope that who I am sober standing in front of you today vaguely resembles the woman I was 2 years ago. I hope the woman I am standing in front of you vaguely resembles who I was last week. And I want you to know that you have my permission when you're sitting in meetings with me, when you're going to conventions with me. If my life doesn't tell you that I am sober, somebody better say something. Somebody say something. Said, you know, Brenda, I saw you at the convention. You look good. 2 years later, you look not so good. What happened? Are you going to meetings? Do you have a sponsor? Have you opened the books? Have you written down any feelings? Have you surrendered at all? Are you trying something different? Are you showing up for your life? What's going on? Somebody better ask me. Because I don't know about you, but when I went to go work my first fifth step, I went to go meet my sponsor at the meeting, and there was a guy named Lloyd, and he's probably going to get the CD, oh God. Okay, so Lloyd was standing behind the counter, and he had 22 years sober. And I walked into the meeting, and I was going to tell my sponsor, you know what? I can't do it. I can't do it. I thought I could. I wrote it all down. I told the truth. But now that it's come time for me to tell it to you, I can't do it. And by God's grace, what I had a chance to do before I made it to my sponsor to tell her that was I had a chance to walk by Lloyd. And this question ran through my mind. Do you want what he has? Clearly no. Hey, you know what? If y'all are going to get ahead of me, I'm not going to share. But no. No, and so that was all it took for me to go do it. I'm sober today by the grace of God. I'm sober today because God has done more to make that possible than I have. I'm sober today because for every day I've wanted to do one thing different than the way I did it before. There's a book, the Living Sober book, that said, you know, I don't know if it actually says it in there. Read it, but there I go. Hey, somebody's going to say, is she making money off the literature? But somewhere in there it says that you can only go as far in recovery as your definition will take you. Unless you wrote it, I don't want to talk to you. She said, it's probably not in that book. Well, read another one. I don't know where it is, but I believe it. I believe that I can only go as far as my definition is going to take me. If what I define recovery to be is not drinking, I get to not drink. If I define recovery as not drinking and having friends, I get to not drink and have friends. Whatever my definition is, I get to go there. And I want you to know that I stand before you sober tonight because my definition of recovery involves the word rocketed into the fourth dimension. Absolutely. Absolutely. And nowhere in the literature does it say that once we have been rocketed that we have to come back. Woo! So I want y'all to know I have set up a permanent mailbox. Oh my God, you know. And so how do you go from where I was to where I am? And for those of you who don't believe I'm alcoholic, let me just settle it for you. Three lines. I drank at the beginning because I wanted to feel good. Then somewhere I started drinking because I wanted to feel normal. And then I don't know what day I started drinking to not feel. And then I wound up in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, first drink when I was 4 out of a Schlitz, tall boy, and nobody thought that was weird. You know, and at 12 I decided I might be able to make a living at this. You know, and so I was in the 6th grade and I was already drinking. And every time I'd get a chance to drink, I'd drink. You know, and I come from a long line of people who drink a lot. And so I came by all my stuff, honestly. I tell everybody I picked up my dad's 2 bad habits. But anyway. I'm one of 9 children. I have 6 sisters and 2 brothers. I have 25, 26 nephews and nieces, 11 12 great nephews and nieces. I have no idea. I just know that I show up sober there every day, and it's an incredible, incredible adventure. And so what happened to me was that I was 24 and my life was falling apart. I had tried the very best I could and the result was nil. And nil is a short word for pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. So if you want to buy a vowel, go for the longer one. If not, just go for nil. And no matter which direction I tried to propel my life, I couldn't get there. If I wanted to go to school, I couldn't get there by myself. If I wanted to go get that great job, I couldn't get there. If I wanted to be in that relationship, I couldn't get there. Now, I knew I knew where I wanted to go. I knew the difference between right and wrong. I knew the difference between what was okay and what wasn't. I just didn't have enough power to propel myself there. Because I would take a drink and then it was all over. I would just take a drink and then I'd have to sit down and think about it. For a long time. I would think about it so long until I forgot what it was we were thinking about. So people that, you know, when I was just like barely drunk would say, what are you doing? I'm like, I got a lot to think about. You know, but like by the time I was way drunk, they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I don't know. I think I was thinking, but I don't know now. And so I was 24 years old and my life hurt. And everywhere that I had tried to go get help, I had gotten hurt. My story is very much like your story. The things that were inappropriate and wrong that happened to me when I was a child happened to you, some of you not, whatever. That's that story. And I think that oftentimes for me, I want to talk about what's on the other side of that. You know, I don't spend a lot of time talking about what it was like to be drunk. I'm assuming you got that part down. You know, and it's part of my conflict when I go listen to speakers, you know, they're like drunk till 10 till, you know, and it's like. I love y'all so much. Let me tell you why I love you, because I said that and they're like, well, I do that. What's wrong with that? Absolutely nothing. Nothing. But it's just not what I do. I was in San Francisco and this guy comes up to me and goes, you know, you really need to spend a lot more time identifying with the newcomer. Because identification is a, you know, the thing that keeps people here. So you really need to, you know, talk a lot more to the newcomers about what it was like to be drinking and stuff. And I said, sir, if you've been around Alcoholics Anonymous as long as I have, 85% of the speakers will do that crap for you. So send them to those meetings. They ask me to share my experience, strength, and hope. When they ask you, you share yours. You know, I just think it takes all of us. I think that it takes all of us. And in no way does my being here and in no way does my message dilute from the fact that I am first and foremost an alcoholic who could not stop drinking, no matter what. Everything else was second to that. I'm here. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I say I am. And I read the traditions, and ironically, that's one of the first ones I came across, because I found out they can't throw you out. And when you're a newcomer, like I was a newcomer, that's an important bit of information. And so somehow I wound up in treatment, and I went to AA, and I wasn't really happy. Okay, and I'll just tell you some of the crap that happened to me when I got here. And excuse me, those of you who already know it, tough crap. So, what happened was that I started coming to meetings. And the first couple of meetings, I looked around, and the first woman, the first meeting I went to was a woman's meeting. And there was a lady that came up to me, and she goes, hi, my name is Pam, and I was just going to let you know that a lot of us are going to go to the kettle after the meeting, and we were wondering, did you want to go? Sometimes I get nauseous telling that story. And I'm like, no. No, I don't want to. And so I end up at the kettle with these people. And I kid around about this, but there was about maybe 10 or 11, 12 women sitting at this long table, and I looked down the table, and the image of the Last Supper came into my head. And I picked up phone numbers, you know, and I started going to meetings, and I was really pissed. I was 24 years old, and don't do the math, I'm 41. And I was 24 years old, and God, golly, it was just wrong to have to be at the Avon convention all the time now. And so I got phone numbers and stuff, and Pam came up to me and she says, you know, you need a sponsor. Bad. She goes, here's my number. I want you to call me. And I said, when should I call you? And she says, anytime you have an idea. Now, I knew I should be offended, but I couldn't tell you how come. And so where I sobered up was a group out in West Texas, the Sherwood Group. Don't go there if you're ever in the area. I'm not kidding. No. So that's where I sobered up, and I'm going to meetings, but like I was trying to blend in, and it was really hard to do because everybody was another color. And so it's real hard to blend in when that's the case. I want you to know there was a guy, he probably had like 30, 40 years, you know, he actually looked like a dinosaur, and he would sit in the lounge outside, and one day I walked through and he said, you know, they have meetings on the other side of the track for people like you. And I walked inside, and I was very early in sobriety. I didn't even have, I don't think I had 3 months, maybe. I was very early in sobriety. But I had heard that phrase that, you know, there's an elephant in the living room and nobody talks about it. So I went in and I sat down and I said, here's my dollar, which somehow entitled me to say whatever the hell I wanted to. Because where I came from, a dollar bought a lot. And so I said, since you asked for a topic, I just wanted to mention there's an actual elephant in the lounge outside, and it's a white elephant. And something really important happened to me that day. Because what happened was, I said, was, and he told me that there's AA meetings on the other side of the track for people like me. And I want you to know that I earned my seat here. And that I can go anywhere in AA. And that I don't have to go on the other side of the tracks. And I want you to know that what he just said to me scared me. And I started crying. And I said, it scares me because I don't have anywhere else to go. And if I'm going to come here and somebody's tell me that I can't come here, then I'm probably going to die. And that scares me. And I figured I'd come to the end of whatever a dollar bought me. And I got up and I left the meeting, you know. And what happened next was incredible. What happened next was I came back the next day. That's what's incredible. I came back the next day. So, you know, I'm trying to blend in, but it's not working. I'm sitting, there's a smoking section, a non-smoking section, and they should have had a grumpier than hell section. Because that's me. And I would sit and I'd just, you know, and they'd say, you want to share? You know, because I look like I have something to share. And then I would share things that I can't repeat from this podium tonight. I'm not kidding. In a meeting. Because what I was trying to say was, leave me alone. I need you. Don't touch me. Hug me! So don't be scared by the newcomers. They don't know. They don't know either. They show up in the best possible condition their alcoholism left them in. They show up in the best possible condition that their alcoholism beat them into. So when you see me again, do what they did. They looked at me when I would share everything that was in four letters. And, of course, I can do it in two languages. They looked at me and in an utter moment of confusion said, keep coming back. So I started going to meetings, and I'm just bopping right along, and I'm not happy to be there, and I would take my newspaper. Yeah, as soon as the meeting would start, I'd open it. And the old-timers would share, you know, if you're not ready, you really don't need to be in AA, and whatever. I love them. And so the next day that I would bring my headphones. Because I didn't understand what anybody was talking about. Because I didn't belong there, but I didn't know where to go. Because I didn't know how to tell you that. I would read the words off the wall. And I didn't know what it meant. And I knew somewhere at the bottom of my soul that I didn't have anywhere else to go. That there was no other treatment for what ailed me. And so I just kept going to meetings. And if you get the books and you read that part that says, God, I offer myself to you, even if you don't mean it, if you're just reading it as a spectator, God is listening. And so I just got to that place and I was just reading it and I didn't mean it or nothing. And so before I was 30 days sober, I was in college. That woman right there just looked as horrified as I did. I did. I just like was reading and it's like, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the money. And then I wound up in college. And I don't know how I came to in a English literature before the 1800s class. We were reading Madame Bovary. You laugh. And so I just started, I go into college and I just was going to meetings and I'm just putting one foot in front of the other. And what happened was that very soon after I got sober, this lady comes up to me and she goes, come here. She goes, we want you to pick up all of the ashtrays and throw the ashes away in the trash can. Then we're going to wash them and get them ready for the next meeting. And I looked at her and I thought to myself, it's because I'm brown. And I believe we need to deal with this today. So I picked up the ashtray, and I'm not kidding. It was like this deep in ashes. And I picked it up and I flung it across the AA room, and cigarettes and ashes. It looked like a volcano had erupted in there. She goes, come here. And I thought, lady, I have no problems with kicking your ass today. So I walk over here and I walk this close to her. And I said, you need something? She said, yeah. She said, we're not going to start you off with the ashtray. She said, pick up the styrofoam coffee cup. Did you ever, like, feel demoted? And it wasn't even a job I wanted. I just, So I kept going to meetings, and I'm not happy to be there. I'm going to college. I'm trying to, you know, not let you help me. I have no idea what the hell is going on, you know. I'm trying to get promoted to ashtrays, and this guy was going to meetings, and his name was Pat, and he had like 2 years sober. And I said, Pat, I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm kind of trying this, and I don't know what's wrong with me. I said, I want a drink. He said, I know exactly what you're talking about. He said, I felt exactly the same way. He said, here's what you need to do. If you know what you know, and you're reading the books and stuff, and you don't want to drink, what you need to do is you need to sleep with me. And And I hadn't read the literature. I don't know what's in there. So I went out to the lobby and I picked up the phone and I said, "Pam, it's Brenda. I'm at the club and I was helping clean, and Pat said that if I wanted to drink that I should sleep with him, and I was calling you because it sounded like an idea." It's for you. I don't know what she said to him, but I never saw him again. I'm not kidding, ever. And by the way, I read the literature. It's not in there. So anyway, the long and the short of it, I'm going to fast forward through all of that because I ended up just staying sober, and I graduated from college and I got a teaching degree, and that's what I do for a living now. I teach children. And the first year I taught back in Texas, they took the standardized testing, the tax test. You know, I tell my friends it's how we determine who goes to heaven. But the kids took the test, and I really had no idea what the hell I was doing. I was teaching sixth grade, and in the sixth grade, I was drinking. So, you know, I really don't know what we covered. And so I'd go to school every day, and there was a stack of books, and I'm like, "What do y'all want to talk about today?" And they're like, "Well, airplanes." And I'm like, "Whoa, that's good. Let's go." And so we'd just look up crap, and we'd make airplanes, and, you know, whatever. So we had a great time. And when it came time for them to take the test, they scored a perfect 100 in reading and a perfect 100 in math. And the superintendent's office called and said, "You know, that's pretty remarkable for a first-year teacher. We're wondering if you could give an in-service to some teachers." "Ma'am, you're about to go to timeout, okay?" I have a feeling she has spent a good deal of time in timeout. So he said, "I wondered if you'd give an in-service to about 800 teachers and tell them a little bit about how you did it." I said, "I would love to." And so I go and I give this in-service, and I'm standing in front of these teachers, and they're like, "Yes, how did you help the children to master the manipulation?" And I'm like, she was asking the question, and I thought, "Has any of your kids killed themselves?" Anyway, so I tell these teachers, I said, "Look, here's how it is. What happened was that I went and dealt with my stuff. I went and dealt with my anger so that when my children showed up angry, it didn't frighten me. I went and dealt with my grief so when their grief came to the classroom, it didn't frighten me. I went and dealt with my betrayal, my sense of abandonment, my disillusionment, my hopelessness, my grief, all of that. I went and did that, and then I showed up every day physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually for the lives of these children." I said, do that or go do something else. Don't be in a place where the future comes to you every day. There is something that will light that fire. There is something that is planned for you to do. And if this isn't it, and what you need is permission to go, I'm here to give it to you. They never asked me to do another in-service. I love the children. Absolutely love the children. Absolutely. I had a little girl who had all four wisdom teeth taken out and came back to school looking like one of the chipmunks. And I said, "Brittany, what are you doing here, honey?" "She said, well, mom wants to talk to you." And I'm like, her mom wants to talk to me. So I'm like, "What is she doing here?" She said, she didn't want to miss anything. Aww. You know, and it hasn't been perfect. I'll be the first to tell you, you know, I had a little boy who fainted in my class once, and I thought he was playing. And one of the little girls raised her hand and goes, "Thomas fainted." And I said, "Kick him." So when he didn't get up, I realized that he was out cold, you know. So So we had to call the ambulance. His mom came and got him or whatever. And about sometime in the afternoon, here comes Thomas. And I said, son, what are you doing here? He said, my mom's outside. She'd like to talk to you. So I went outside. I have to tell you, I thought, I wonder if he remembers being kicked. So I go outside and I said, what's the matter? She goes, I don't know. He passed out and they're going to run some tests. And he seems to be having some sort of seizure stuff. And I said, what's he doing here? She said, he told me that he wanted to come back because if anything happened to him, that you'd know what to do. She was right. She was right. And I just showed up for these children and I did those things. And every year I'd get a new class of kids. I'd get a new class of kids who had the tiger by the tail. And when I left teaching in Texas, one of the little boys gave me a box. And it had a helicopter in there, a model helicopter and a model boat that he had made. And he gave it to me with a little card that says, here for a teacher that's going places. Ah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I have to tell you that that's what I do for a living now, you know. And it's, I just wanted another life from the one I had. And so if I wanted something different, I had to get willing to do something different. And in my case, anything different would work. And so I'd get my sponsor and she'd make a suggestion and I'm like, that is the stupidest thing I have ever heard in all of my life. And I have heard a lot of stupid things. Now, I didn't say that out loud. On the outside, I would go, I'll consider that. So one of my things used to be that I had to have the last word in any argument. Whether you were there in person, whether you were in the TV, you know, it didn't matter. I would turn it off. Ha! There was no shut up button installed at all. Had to have the last word no matter what. And especially with one of my sisters who I affectionately refer to as Satan. Still today. But so I would like argue with her and that caused a lot of dissension and a lot of pain and a lot of friction and fracture in my family. And my sponsor said to me, well, here's an idea. Next time you find yourself in a heated discussion with her, why don't you just stop for a minute and say the words, you may be right. And I thought, if I stop to explain why I can't do that to my sponsor, we're going to be here a while. She goes, I'm not telling you have to do it. Just try it. Because what you're doing doesn't seem to be working. Sure enough, in not too short order after that, I'm in a heated discussion in the living room of my mother's house with Satan, you know, and I'm just red. But you can't tell because I'm brown, but under the brown, I'm red because I'm so pissed, right? And this thought came to my mind and it said, excuse me. This is the moment that your sponsor was speaking of when she mentioned that you might try something different. And I just wanted to make you aware that this was the actual time. Now that's going on in my head while I'm screaming. And I said, wait a minute. Wait. And I looked at her and I said, You may be right. And then the absolute worst thing that could have happened. I started to cry. And I didn't mean to, but then I couldn't stop it. I started to cry because I knew I wanted something different and this was the way there and the way there hurt. And I walked away. For the first time in my life. And what happened the next day was I woke up and I felt sober. I felt like I was participating. You know, and I wish I could tell you that I learned those lessons early in recovery and then it never was a problem. Everyone who's laughing out of turn, don't do that. But what happened really is that it continued to be a problem because I continued to be in my way. My alcoholic does not wish to relinquish control. It will go to a meeting, hear some really inspirational crap during the Lord's Prayer while we're holding hands. My alcoholic will get up and erase the board. So that no new information is getting in. And you know if this is happening to you because you leave the meeting and go, God, that was some good stuff. I feel so much better. What did she say? And so I had to start writing it down in my books. To this day, I carry my books to a meeting and I make notes because my alcoholic does not wish to relinquish control. And I went to a video store one time, and you know, here's my amends story, no way to save your ass and your face. And I went to the video store and I said, I would like to rent this video, and it said 99 cents, I thought. So, and the lady said, that's $2.99 or something. And I said, look, y'all need to get y'all crap together, okay? Because this movie is 99 cents. And she's like, no, ma'am, and now I'm throwing a tirade, and I'm like 8 years sober, okay? This isn't like new behavior. And so, like, in the midst of this tirade that I'm throwing, the little stock guy comes over, and sure enough, he's got a little note that came off the wall that said this movie's $2.99. So I did the only sober thing I knew how to do. Never mind, I don't want it! And I stomp out of the store. Now, the way I knew I was making progress is that before I got to the car, two important things happened. One, I started crying. And two, I thought to myself, I don't even need to call my sponsor, I got this one. So I walk back in there and I'm crying, and it's not pretty. It's not a pretty cry, okay? It's not a pretty cry. I'm crying, and now I'm going to make amends, but I have to wait in line. That kind of crying. Okay? I'm waiting in line. People are like, shit, what movie did she want? They're like, these are pretty good. You want it? Let me pay for it. I got it, you know? And so, because like now I'm putting the store under stress. Okay? So I get up there and I'm like, I just want you to know that I'm sorry, and I know that I'm not supposed to talk to you like that, and I don't know what happened, and I'll never do it. The girl says to me, ma'am, I've never seen you before in my life, but I think you're looking for Brittany, and she's working in the back now. I want you to know people were falling out laughing. And I wanted so bad to tell her, could you just tell her for me? So there I go to the back of the store, and people like stop shopping. They're like, look, there she goes. Look. Which one's Brittany? Which one's Brittany? Let's see. So I get back there and I do that deal again. I walk all through the store, and I felt like people wanted to clap on the way out. Way to go! And I get out to the car and I'm still crying, but something happened to me. I felt sober. I felt sober. I was free that day. I've worked every step I've ever worked in Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted to be free. I've taken every inventory and picked up every ashtray and sponsored every woman and taken every meeting to every institution because I've wanted to be free. A minute ago, somebody said, would you rather be right or happy? I think the real question is, would you rather be right or be left? I'd rather be left right here. Absolutely. And I want you to know that I've done everything I can to put the relationships with my brothers and sisters back together again. My relationship with my father was particularly painful because he wanted more from me than I could give him. He wanted the daughter he brought home from the hospital, and I didn't turn out to be that. I always felt like there was something wrong with me and I couldn't do it, and all of that just came out sideways in those relationships. You know, and I made amends to my brothers and sisters, and I made amends for the things that I couldn't do for them or with them. I took a drink and I left. I was absent, physically absent, emotionally absent. I left. And when they wanted more from me than I could do, I made them feel bad about it. I made them think there was something wrong with them for wanting that from me. You know, and I remember that I was resentful because my father didn't pick me up. He didn't hold me. He didn't look me in the eye and tell me that I was beautiful and that he loved me. That didn't happen. Why not? Well, not because that wasn't the truth. One, he was orphaned when he was 4. And 2, there were 9 of us who had time. Really. He was the only one working, trying to keep us all clothed and fed and happy and in a home, for God's sakes. You know, so now I get sober and I'm walking through Alcoholics Anonymous trying to better my life. And what happened was that my father got sick. The first week I started teaching, he got sick. And I went over to his house and I was sitting on the bed across from his bed, and I look over at him and he looked like a little boy. And my father had never looked like a little boy to me. And this question, this sober question came to me. Can you do for your father what he could never do for you? And I said, yes. And I walked over to my dad and I sat down on the bed and I let my shoulder touch his shoulder and I let my knee touch his knee. And I sat there next to him and I said, Dad, I love you. I'm not leaving. You are a very beautiful man. I want you to know that of all the men that God could have given me to be my father, I'm so glad I got you. And my father stood up and he just started sobbing. He sobbed for a lot of reasons that day. He sobbed because I'd finally shown up. He sobbed because he could finally stop holding his breath. I was just concerned with the fact that I'd been holding mine. And he put his arms around me. And he just sobbed. And I held him. And he held me. And everything I'd ever waited for there, it didn't matter anymore. It was okay. I felt sober. You know, and that was a long journey with my father that ended on Christmas Eve 2 years ago. The 9 of us went back home to San Angelo. I was living in Dallas now, and the 9 of us went home. And we got to spend the last 2 months with my father under one roof again for the first time ever. By the time those of us at the end of the line were born, the older ones were married and gone. For the first time in all of our lives, the 9 of us got to be there with my dad. And at the end, it got so painful that we could only do it in 30-minute shifts. Because you can only hold your breath for so long. And we'd change him, and we'd change his clothes, and we'd do laundry in the kitchen. There was a blow-up air mattress in the kitchen. I'm not kidding. It's like when you wake up, wash something, you know? Because here are all these little children, and you know, and before my father died, it was a few days before he died, and he was in, and he kept doing like this to his stomach, and nobody could figure out, and I was the one that was giving him his medicine, and they said, Brenda, come see what he wants, and I went in there, and I'm like, what is it, Dad? And he couldn't talk anymore, and he kept doing like this on his stomach, and I said, what is it? Do you hurt? I said, are you in pain? And he just kept going like this, and I went, I said, do you want me to play my guitar? He went, Now my father had taught me to play the guitar. When I was 4, I was playing the guitar already, and he'd set me up on the bar, and he put a little hat in front of me, and I was cute. Even then, I knew how to shake my booty. And he'd sit me up there, and I'd go with him, and it was this great thing. And so I went in the other room because I couldn't do it in the room where he was. And I went and I sat in the kitchen, and I pulled up an ice chest, and I threw my feet on it, and I picked up my guitar, and I sang. I sang all the songs my father taught me. I sang all the songs my father loved. I sang the songs my father sang to my mother. I sang the church songs that they taught me that we'd all grown up with, and before too long we were all sitting in that kitchen with tears. Because it was over. And the morning of Christmas Eve, I went in and it was 1:15 or so and 1:45. I went in and I was going to give him the morphine in the side of his mouth, and he was desperate. He didn't want the lights out. His eyes were open. He was scared, and I thought, you know what? We're going to do something else. And I didn't give him the medicine. I walked over to him and I knelt by his bed and I put one hand on his heart and the other one on his eyes and I rocked him. And I said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It was all I knew how to do. And I rocked him, and I prayed with him, and I sang to him. And at 4:15 on Christmas Eve, my father died. And the little kids, you know, my little nephews and nieces, they just kept climbing in and out of my lap. I would sit in the chair and here they'd come and I would just hold them. And I'd rock them and I'd tell them grandpa stories and they'd get off and here comes the next one. And I have to tell you, one of the sweetest things that happened was that I have a nephew and he's 15 and he came over and he sat in my lap and he just couldn't do it, you know. And I was sober and I was in my body and, you know, and these little kids are like, where'd grandpa go? And why do we have to put him in the hole in the ground? And I said, well, as it turns out, grandpa's going to a party. And we're going to put him in the ground because the train's going to come by and pick him up for the party. The kids are going to grow up later and be terrified of subways. And so there we are on December 27th, my little sister's birthday, at the graveside burying my father. Cold, cold, cold outside. And we let go all these balloons. And I had played my guitar and sang at the graveside and did all of that. And up comes little Gabriel. He said, we forgot. I said, we forgot what? He said, we forgot Grandpa's favorite song. I went, oh, okay. All right, well, come on then. And here come all these little kids. And in our best Christmas voices, we sang Jingle Bells. And I left the next day, and I went home to Dallas. And when I got home to Dallas, I took my stuff upstairs to my apartment. I locked the door behind me. I went to my bedroom, I hit my knees, and I thank God. From the bottom of my heart, I thank God that I was that woman, that I was that sober woman that you had made me, the one that you didn't give up on, the one that you trusted, the one that you helped, the one that you believed in, the one that you held. I was that woman. You know, and I come and I didn't speak for the first 12 years I was sober. I mean, I didn't go to conventions and all that crap because, you know, I had a lot of work to do, you know, and and every time I'd look up and God would say no, and I'm like, okay. And so I had a lot of stuff to work through and stuff. And then I got them to be like 12 and a half years, maybe 13 years sober. And I got an invitation to go speak at Dallas at the Big D Roundup. And I looked at God and I said, he said, yep, we can go now. And by the way, this is your coming out party. So I did. I went to Dallas, Texas, and I just gave them all the hell they could handle. And I want you to know that in short order, because God has bigger plans for me than I have for myself. I moved there. I moved to Dallas and I started attending the SMU School of Theology, the Perkins School of Theology, and I went a semester and then they found out I was gay and I had to go. I mean, you can only be on so many prayer lists and then there is a cutoff. But I had to check out of school, and when I checked out of school, I checked out and I was on the A honor roll at that school. and I hadn't read any of the books. And I would go to class and I would pay attention. And one day one of the professors said this prayer that changed my life. And that may have been the whole reason I had to be at that Perkins School of Theology. The professor would pray every morning before we had class. And one day he closed his eyes and he said, God, how come every time I draw a line in the sand between me and them, when I open my eyes, you're over there with them? Changed my life. I stopped drawing lines in the sand, because if God's over there with them, that's where I want to be too. And I started going, I said, got a home group and I'm doing the deal and I'm paying attention and I'm just rocking right along. And I have just about had all I wanted of relationships because, yuck. Because it had been my experience that while people were doing the very best they could, at some point they were no longer in love with you, but rather your potential. So I was kind of tired and kind of done. And so when I got invited to come speak at the state convention here a couple of years ago, I thought, you know, okay, y'all have heard my CD, right? Because it was the first straight convention I'd ever spoken at, right? And I'm like... And so I did. I went and I did that deal and I paid attention and I surrendered my will and my life to God. And after I do that, the rest of it is none of my business. Absolutely. And so I went and I did it and something hugely important happened in my life. I had an experience of God. And it was the first time that I'd ever gone to go speak somewhere, that when I got on the plane to go home, I had a feeling that I actually was home and I just went back to go get my stuff. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I went to that convention and I met Judy. And I met Judy and somebody said, Brenda, this is Judy, Judy, this is Brenda. And the first thing out of my mouth was, yes, God. Whatever you want is okay with me. And so I share that with you just because I want you to know that as it turns out, she's actually living in the fourth dimension also. I had always asked God for a partner who loved God more than they love me. And I have that. And because I just get out of the way and I do the very best I can, I got a job in Tampa. And I moved here in April. Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's God's will. That's why. It's God's will. And that's why I get to come here. And that's why I get to have this experience. And that's why I'm in Cocoa Beach. That's why I'm here this weekend. Because what God has planned for me is far greater than anything I could have planned for myself. Don't waste it. Don't waste it. This chance, we don't need a second chance. This one's working just fine. So this weekend, we have this huge invitation. This huge invitation that will be extended to each other in conversation. We'll get to extend it one-on-one. We'll get to extend it here together. But I want you to know that if you accept the invitation that this weekend is issuing you to come and tell the truth, to come and just try something, anything, any page, any step, anything besides what you got going on would be good. Absolutely. And those of you who are walking around and walking on clouds, absolutely, welcome. Welcome. You're necessary. You're needed. You're important. You matter. And after I get done speaking, I'm going to stand over there somewhere and I'm giving away free hugs. Yeah. Hey. And I don't want to hear any of this, well, the speaker was too busy after. Kiss my butt. No, I'm not. I have come and accepted the invitation, and I've come to issue one. Welcome to greatness. Welcome to a moment of surrender. Welcome to a moment when we have an opportunity to reach for a power beyond ourselves. And I'm going to close with something, then I'm going to go home. I mean, not home, but you know what I mean. I'll be here. Still more wonderful is the fact that we need not be specially distinguished from our fellows to be useful and profoundly happy. Thank you very much. Thank you. Service gladly rendered. That's what this was. Service gladly rendered. Obligations squarely met. Troubles well accepted or solved with God's help. The knowledge that at home and the world outside, we are partners in a common effort. The well understood fact that in God's sight, all human beings are important. The proof that love freely given surely brings a full return. The certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons, but that we belong in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living, for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could ever substitute. True ambition is not what we thought it to be. True ambition is a deep desire to live usefully and to walk humbly in the grace of God. And I want you to know that tonight, standing here before you, I feel sober. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.